Books on Tape presents Soldiers and Slaves, American POWs Trapped by the Nazis' Final Gamble, by Roger Cohen. Read by Michael Pritchard. Chapter 1. The Devil Quotes Scripture. A heavily padlocked steel door, topped by a barred vent, swings open, and from the depths of the tunnel, a current of cold air is released into the summer haze. All is quiet. The White Elster River flows lazily, flies hovering at its eddying surface. On the far bank, visible through the trees, lies the small eastern German town of Berge. The tranquility seems real, but it is an illusion. Germany must be seen in space and in time. To see what is there, it is necessary to see what is hidden. At this spot, the tunnel extends about 150 feet into the tree-covered hillside. Water drips, some of it close by, some deep in the bluff. A few boulders and scattered rocks lie around small pools of water. The shaft, with its jagged walls of black slate, is still and damp. But beyond the peace lies something else. The sound wells from the depths of the tunnel, advancing across the years. A sound of rending and blasting, of screeching and booming, of screams and pandemonium fills this confined space. The tunnel, perhaps 20 feet high and 15 feet wide, is peopled now with bedraggled men, their faces blackened with dust, drilling and shoveling and heaving and loading as explosions turn the air into a lacerating gale of fine shards. The fragments penetrate the unprotected mouths of American and European prisoners of the Nazis, cutting their throats, devouring their lungs, weakening them day by day. The Americans are young, most of them no more than 20 years old, from Ohio and Virginia, New York and California. They have been sucked into a place they cannot comprehend. It is March 1945. The war is almost over, but these GIs are dying at a rate unknown among American prisoners of war elsewhere in Europe. Each day they are herded into the tunnels. They have scarcely been fed, they have no protective clothing, and their cuts are infected. But still they must hold the heavy pneumatic drills against the rock face and bore a hole sufficiently large for the German engineers to insert dynamite. When the explosion comes, they are pushed back deep into the tunnels. They must pick up the rocks, some of them large and unwieldy, and load them onto small carts that run on a narrow-gauge railroad track. They have no gloves. Their hands are a mess of scratches and wounds. They push the carts down to the river and empty them. If they slow down for a moment, they are beaten by the guards. One of the Americans is Sanford M. Lubinsky of Lima, Ohio, captured by the Germans at the Battle of the Bulge and brought here because he has been identified as a Jew. Lubinsky, a private in the 28th Infantry Division, has to maneuver the drill. But sometimes his strength gives out. My arms were coming down slowly. And so it happened that when that SS guy came through inspecting with his whip and his stick, hateful, strutting in, at that time my arms gave way and that drill came falling down. Oh, was he mad. You damn Jew, the SS guard said. The SS man grabs a shovel. He hits Lubinsky in the back, crushing part of it. He kicks him when he goes down, then takes out his whip. Lubinsky curses the German. He is now beyond caring about his fate. I didn't care. I thought I was going anyway. The heck with him. What kept me going, I guess, was a fighting hate. I wanted to get out of there. I was going to get out somehow and kill those dirty sons of bitches. Every afternoon when the sun shines, 4 or 5 old women gather on a bench in the main square of Berge. The town is quiet today. Too quiet. A flag flaps. Children's voices carry from distant gardens of roses and sunflowers. An air of abandonment pervades the neighborhood. The plasterwork of the town hall is crumbling. The textile factory that once produced kit for the doped and indomitable East German Olympic team is a ghostly sprawl. A new clock scarcely uplifts a red brick train station that has not been refurbished in decades. In the west of Germany, after World War II, the past was quickly swept away. All the putrescent ruins of war were removed to make way for shopping centers and slabs of abstract art, and homes with geranium-filled window boxes, places so anodyne, so lulled by prosperity, they speak only of a placid existence and the rewards of striving. Chapter 2 Sucker Punch. Within days, the gruesome became commonplace. Private William J. Shapiro would watch from a distance as shells slammed into foxholes and know, before he got there, what to expect. Body parts all over the place. Intestines spilled. Blood seeping into the earth. He would look for movement, signaling life. Without it, or a sound, however faint, there was no point hanging around. To do so was to invite being hit by the next round. In combat, he had learned quickly that the most important thing was to keep moving, no matter what. As a frontline medic with the 28th Infantry Division, Shapiro, aged 19, had to look out for the living. It was not his job to tag the mounting American dead. More than 11,000 of them in Normandy within 4 weeks of D-Day, June 6, 1944. But life could be hard to discern in the carnage. Chest wounds were often invisible because the blood did not always soak through uniforms, with the result that the injury was betrayed only by gasping. Morphine was the standard treatment. Shapiro carried the drug in tiny, needle-tipped aluminum tubes. After giving the injection, he would tag the injured soldier to ensure that another dose was not administered too soon by somebody back at the battalion aid station. If a GI was hit in a limb, Shapiro would give the shot and apply a tourniquet. Then word was sent with a rifleman or runner for the litter-bearers to come and collect the wounded and the dead. Triage was done back at the aid station by the medical officer, but Shapiro could not help doing his own. He found that he involuntarily distinguished those who would survive from those who would not. Death did not advance unannounced. It clouded the eyes before occupying them entirely. A sudden blankness. As for his own mortality, in combat, Shapiro scarcely gave it a thought. Through the French hedgerows, he would follow 50 yards behind the rifleman of his platoon. If one was hit and shouted, "Medic!" he would rush forward to see what had happened. That movement, into a position where a fellow soldier had just been hit by shrapnel or a bullet, became automatic. Shapiro, through a mysterious process, was subsumed into his unit. An unspoken pact existed. The riflemen protected him until they no longer could, whereupon he tried to save them. His individuality, his life itself, had ceased to have much meaning. All that was left was what had to be done: provide relief where possible. The fear that haunted him on arrival in Normandy and preceded battle evaporated, and the rules of his existence became simple. Shoot or be shot. Tag the injured and move on. Feel nothing because in feeling may lie hesitation. What the GIs had been taught in the United States seemed almost quaint, a bloodless imitation of battle where you took aim from more than 100 yards. Here men were cut down by shots fired from 10 feet away. You watch them die in detail, the blood seeping from the mouth, arms thrown back, eyes shocked, then expressionless. You got very cold after a while. A few GIs could not take it. They saw a lead scout or two killed, and they cracked, crawled back to the rear on their stomachs, eyes wild, muttering that they had to get out, get back, get home. You lived with that for the rest of your life. Perhaps it was better to die. but not slowly.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?